Chapter 34. The Prisoners Start for Siberia. The gang of prisoners, among whom was Maslova, was to leave Moscow by rail at 3 p.m. Therefore, in order to see the gang start and walk to the station with the prisoners, Nekhludov meant to reach the prison before 12 o'clock. The night before, as he was packing up and sorting his papers, he came upon his diary, and read some bits here and there. The last bit, written before he left for Petersburg, ran thus: "Katyusha does not wish to accept my sacrifice. She wishes to make a sacrifice herself. She has conquered, and so have I. She makes me happy by the inner change which seems to me, though I fear to believe it, to be going on in her. I fear to believe it, yet she seems to be coming back to life." Then further on he read, "I have lived through something very hard and very joyful. I learnt that she has behaved very badly in the hospital, and I suddenly felt great pain. I never expected that it could be so painful. I spoke to her with loathing and hatred, then all of a sudden I called to mind how many times I have been, and even still am, though but in thought, guilty of the thing that I hated her for, and immediately I became disgusting to myself, and pitied her, and felt happy again. If only we could manage to see the beam in our own eye in time, how kind we should be." Then he wrote, "I have been to see Natalie, and again self-satisfaction made me unkind and spiteful, and a heavy feeling remains. Well, what is to be done? Tomorrow a new life will begin. A final good-bye to the old. Many new impressions have accumulated, but I cannot yet bring them to unity." When he awoke the next morning, Nekhludov's first feeling was regret about the affair between him and his brother-in-law. "I cannot go away like this," he thought. "I must go and make it up with them." But when he looked at his watch, he saw that he had not time to go, but must hurry so as not to be too late for the departure of the gang. He hastily got everything ready, and sent the things to the station with a servant and Taras, Theodosia's husband, who was going with them. Then he took the first izvochik he could find, and drove off to the prison. The prisoner's train started 2 hours before the train by which he was going, so Nekhludov paid his bill in the lodgings and left for good. It was July, and the weather was unbearably hot. From the stones, the walls, the iron of the roofs, which the sultry night had not cooled, the beat streamed into the motionless air. When, at rare intervals, a slight breeze did arise, it brought but a whiff of hot air filled with dust and smelling of oil paint. There were few people in the streets, and those who were out tried to keep on the shady side. Only the sunburnt peasants, with their bronzed faces and bark shoes on their feet, who were mending the road, sat hammering the stones into the burning sand in the sun, while the policemen, in their holland blouses, with revolvers fastened with orange cords, stood melancholy and depressed in the middle of the road, changing from foot to foot. And the tramcars, the horses of which wore holland hoods on their heads, with slits for the ears, kept passing up and down the sunny road with ringing bells. When Nekhludov drove up to the prison, the gang had not left the yard. The work of delivering and receiving the prisoners that had commenced at 4 a.m. was still going on. The gang was to consist of 623 men and 64 women. They had all to be received according to the registry lists, the sick and the weak to be sorted out and all to be delivered to the convoy. The new inspector, with two assistants, the doctor and medical assistant, the officer of the convoy and the clerk, were sitting in the prison yard at a table covered with writing materials and papers, which was placed in the shade of a wall. They called the prisoners one by one, examined and questioned them, and took notes. The rays of the sun had gradually reached the table, and it was growing very hot and oppressive for want of air, and because of the breathing crowd of prisoners that stood close by. "Good gracious, will this never come to an end?" the convoy officer, a tall, fat, red-faced man with high shoulders, who kept puffing the smoke of his cigarette into his thick moustache, asked as he drew in a long puff. "You are killing me. From where have you got them all? Are there any more?" the clerk inquired. 24 men and the women. "What are you standing there for? Come on!" shouted the convoy officer to the prisoners, who had not yet passed the revision, and who stood crowded one behind the other. The prisoners had been standing there more than 3 hours, packed in rows in the full sunlight, waiting their turns. While this was going on in the prison yard, outside the gate, besides the sentinel, who stood there as usual with a gun, were drawn up about 20 carts, to carry the luggage of the prisoners and such prisoners as were too weak to walk, and a group of relatives and friends waiting to see the prisoners as they came out, and to exchange a few words if a chance presented itself, and to give them a few things. Nekhludoff took his place among the group. He had stood there about an hour, when the clanking of chains, the noise of footsteps, authoritative voices, the sound of coughing, and the low murmur of a large crowd became audible. This continued for about 5 minutes, during which several jailers went in and out of the gateway. At last the word of command was given. The gate opened with a thundering noise, the clattering of the chains became louder, and the convoy soldiers, dressed in white blouses and carrying guns, came out into the street and took their places in a large, exact circle in front of the gate. This was evidently a usual, often practiced manoeuvre. Then another command was given, and the prisoners began coming out in couples, with flat, pancake-shaped caps on their shaved heads and sacks over their shoulders, dragging their chained legs and swinging one arm while the other held up a sack. First came the men condemned to hard labour, all dressed alike in grey trousers and cloaks with marks on the back, all of them, young and old, thin and fat, pale and red, dark and bearded and beardless, Russians, Tartars and Jews came out, clattering with their chains and briskly swinging their arms as if prepared to go a long distance, but stopped after having taken 10 steps, and obediently took their places behind each other, 4 abreast. Then, without interval, streamed out more shaved men, dressed in the same manner but with chains only on their legs. These were condemned to exile. They came out as briskly and stopped as suddenly, taking their places 4 in a row. Then came those exiled by their communes. Then the women in the same order, first those condemned to hard labour, with grey cloaks and kerchiefs, then the exiled women, and those following their husbands of their own free will, dressed in their own town or village clothing. Some of the women were carrying babies wrapped in the fronts of their grey cloaks. With the women came the children, boys and girls, who, like colts in a herd of horses, pressed in among the prisoners. The men took their places silently, only coughing now and then or making short remarks. The women talked without intermission. Nekhludoff thought he saw Maslova as they were coming out, but she was at once lost in the large crowd, and he could only see grey creatures, seemingly devoid of all that was human, or at any rate of all that was womanly, with sacks on their backs and children round them, taking their places behind the men. Though all the prisoners had been counted inside the prison walls, the convoy counted them again, comparing the numbers with the list. This took very long, especially as some of the prisoners moved and changed places, which confused the convoy. The convoy soldiers shouted and pushed the prisoners, who complied obediently but angrily, and counted them over again. When all had been counted, the convoy officer gave a command, and the crowd became agitated. The weak men and women and children rushed, racing each other towards the carts, and began placing their bags on the carts and climbing up themselves. Women with crying babies, merry children quarrelling for places, and dull, careworn prisoners got into the carts. Several of the prisoners took off their caps and came up to the convoy officer with some request. Nekhludoff found out later that they were asking for places on the carts. Nekhludoff saw how the officer, without looking at the prisoners, drew in a whiff from his cigarette and then suddenly waved his short arm in front of one of the prisoners, who quickly drew his shaved head back between his shoulders, as if afraid of a blow, and sprang back.
"I will give you a lift such that you'll remember. You'll get there on foot, right enough," shouted the officer.
Only one of the men was granted his request, an old man with chains on his legs, and Nekhludoff saw the old man take off his pancake-shaped cap and go up to the cart, crossing himself. He could not manage to get up on the cart because of the chains that prevented his lifting his old legs, and a woman who was sitting in the cart at last pulled him in by the arm. When all the sacks were in the carts, and those who were allowed to get in were seated, the officer took off his cap, wiped his forehead, his bald head and fat red neck, and crossed himself.
"March!" commanded the officer.
The soldiers' guns gave a click. The prisoners took off their caps and crossed themselves. Those who were seeing them off shouted something. The prisoners shouted in answer. A row arose among the women, and the gang, surrounded by the soldiers in their white blouses, moved forward, raising the dust with their chained feet. The soldiers went in front. Then came the convicts, condemned to hard labour, clattering with their chains. Then the exiled, and those exiled by the communes, chained in couples by their wrists. Then the women. After them, on the carts loaded with sacks, came the weak. High up, on one of the carts, sat a woman closely wrapped up, and she kept shrieking and sobbing. Chapter 35. Not men, but strange and terrible creatures. The procession was such a long one that the carts with the luggage and the weak started only when those in front were already out of sight. When the last of the carts moved, Nekhludov got into the trap that stood waiting for him, and told the izvochik to catch up the prisoners in front, so that he could see if he knew any of the men in the gang, and then try and find out Maslova among the women, and ask her if she had received the things he sent. It was very hot, and a cloud of dust that was raised by a thousand tramping feet stood all the time over the gang that was moving down the middle of the street. The prisoners were walking quickly, and the slow-going izvochik's horse was some time in catching them up. Row upon row they passed, those strange and terrible-looking creatures, none of whom Nekhludov knew. On they went, all dressed alike, moving 1,000 feet, all shod alike, swinging their free arms as if to keep up their spirits. There were so many of them, they all looked so much alike, and they were all placed in such unusual, peculiar circumstances that they seemed to Nekhludov to be not men, but some sort of strange and terrible creatures. This impression passed when he recognized in the crowd of convicts the murderer Fyodorov, and among the exiles Okhotin, the wit, and another tramp who had appealed to him for assistance. Almost all the prisoners turned and looked at the trap that was passing them and at the gentleman inside. Fyodorov tossed his head backwards as a sign that he had recognized Nekhludov. Okhotin winked, but neither of them bowed, considering it not the thing. As soon as Nekhludov came up to the women, he saw Maslova. She was in the second row. The first in the row was a short-legged, black-eyed, hideous woman, who had her cloak tucked up in her girdle. This was Khrushchevka. The next was a pregnant woman, who dragged herself along with difficulty. The third was Maslova. She was carrying her sack on her shoulder and looking straight before her. Her face looked calm and determined. The fourth in the row was a young, lovely woman who was walking along briskly, dressed in a short cloak, her kerchief tied in peasant fashion. This was Theodosia. Nekhludov got down and approached the women, meaning to ask Maslova if she had got the things he had sent her, and how she was feeling, but the convoy sergeant who was walking on that side noticed him at once and ran towards him.
"You must not do that, sir! It is against the regulations to approach the gang!"
shouted the sergeant as he came up. But when he recognized Nekhludov, everyone in the prison knew Nekhludov, the sergeant raised his fingers to his cap and, stopping in front of Nekhludov, said,
"Not now. Wait till we get to the railway station. Here it is not allowed. Don't lag behind! March!"
he shouted to the convicts, and putting on a brisk air he ran back to his place at a trot, in spite of the heat and the elegant new boots on his feet. Nekhludov went on to the pavement and told the izvochik to follow him, himself walking so as to keep the convicts in sight. Wherever the gang passed, it attracted attention mixed with horror and compassion. Those who drove past leaned out of the vehicles and followed the prisoners with their eyes. Those on foot stopped and looked with fear and surprise at the terrible sight. Some came up and gave alms to the prisoners. The alms were received by the convoy. Some, as if they were hypnotized, followed the gang, but then stopped, shook their heads, and followed the prisoners only with their eyes. Everywhere the people came out of the gates and doors, and called others to come out too, or leaned out of the windows looking, silent and immovable, at the frightful procession. At a crossroad a fine carriage was stopped by the gang. A fat coachman with a shiny face and two rows of buttons on his back sat on the box. A married couple sat facing the horses, the wife, a pale, thin woman with a light-coloured bonnet on her head and a bright sunshade in her hand, the husband with a top hat and a well-cut, light-coloured overcoat. On the seat in front sat their children, a well-dressed little girl with loose, fair hair and as fresh as a flower, who also held a bright parasol, and an 8-year-old boy with a long, thin neck and sharp collarbones, a sailor hat with long ribbons on his head. The father was angrily scolding the coachman because he had not passed in front of the gang when he had a chance, and the mother frowned and half closed her eyes with a look of disgust, shielding herself from the dust and the sun with her silk sunshade, which she held close to her face. The fat coachman frowned angrily at the unjust rebukes of his master, who had himself given the order to drive along that street, and with difficulty held in the glossy black horses, foaming under their harness and impatient to go on. The policeman wished with all his soul to please the owner of the fine equipage by stopping the gang, yet felt that the dismal solemnity of the procession could not be broken even for so rich a gentleman. He only raised his fingers to his cap to show his respect for riches, and looked severely at the prisoners as if promising in any case to protect the owners of the carriage from them. So the carriage had to wait till the whole of the procession had passed, and could only move on when the last of the carts, laden with sacks and prisoners, rattled by. The hysterical woman who sat on one of the carts and had grown calm again began shrieking and sobbing when she saw the elegant carriage. Then the coachman tightened the reins with a slight touch, and the black trotters, their shoes ringing against the paving stones, drew the carriage, softly swaying on its rubber tires, towards the country house, where the husband, the wife, the girl, and the boy with the sharp collarbones were going to amuse themselves. Neither the father nor the mother gave the girl and boy any explanation of what they had seen, so that the children had themselves to find out the meaning of this curious sight. The girl, taking the expression of her father's and mother's faces into consideration, solved the problem by assuming that these people were quite another kind of men and women than her father and mother and their acquaintances, that they were bad people, and that they had therefore to be treated in the manner they were being treated. Therefore the girl felt nothing but fear, and was glad when she could no longer see those people. But the boy with the long, thin neck, who looked at the procession of prisoners without taking his eyes off them, solved the question differently. He still knew, firmly and without any doubt, for he had it from God, that these people were just the same kind of people as he was, and like all other people, and therefore someone had done these people some wrong, something that ought not to have been done, and he was sorry for them, and felt no horror, either of those who were shaved and chained, or of those who had shaved and chained them. And so the boy's lips pouted more and more, and he made greater and greater efforts not to cry, thinking it a shame to cry in such a case. Chapter 36. The Tender Mercies of the Lord. Nekhludov kept up with the quick pace of the convicts. Though lightly clothed, he felt dreadfully hot, and it was hard to breathe in the stifling, motionless, burning air filled with dust. When he had walked about a quarter of a mile, he again got into the trap, but it felt still hotter in the middle of the street. He tried to recall last night's conversation with his brother-in-law, but the recollections no longer excited him as they had done in the morning. They were dulled by the impressions made by the starting and procession of the gang, and chiefly by the intolerable heat. On the pavement, in the shade of some trees overhanging a fence, he saw two schoolboys standing over a kneeling man who sold ices. One of the boys was already sucking a pink spoon and enjoying his ices. The other was waiting for a glass that was being filled with something yellowish. "Where could I get a drink?" Nekhludov asked his izvochik, feeling an insurmountable desire for some refreshment. "There is a good eating-house close by," the izvochik answered, and turning a corner drove up to a door with a large signboard. The plump clerk in a Russian shirt, who stood behind the counter, and the waiters in their once white clothing who sat at the tables, there being hardly any customers, looked with curiosity at the unusual visitor and offered him their services. Nekhludov asked for a bottle of seltzer water and sat down some way from the window at a small table covered with a dirty cloth. Two men sat at another table with tea things and a white bottle in front of them, mopping their foreheads and calculating something in a friendly manner. One of them was dark and bald, and had just such a border of hair at the back as Rogozhinsky. This sight again reminded Nekhludov of yesterday's talk with his brother-in-law, and his wish to see him and Natalie. "I shall hardly be able to do it before the train starts," he thought. "I'd better write." He asked for paper, an envelope, and a stamp, and as he was sipping the cool, effervescent water, he considered what he should say. But his thoughts wandered, and he could not manage to compose a letter.
"My dear Natalie, I cannot go away with the heavy impression that yesterday's talk with your husband has left," he began.
What next? Shall I ask him to forgive me what I said yesterday? But I only said what I felt, and he will think that I am taking it back. Besides, this interference of his in my private matters... No, I cannot. And again he felt hatred rising in his heart towards that man so foreign to him. He folded the unfinished letter and put it in his pocket, paid, went out, and again got into the trap to catch up the gang. It had grown still hotter. The stones and the walls seemed to be breathing out hot air. The pavement seemed to scorch the feet, and Nekhludov felt a burning sensation in his hand when he touched the lacquered splash guard of his trap. The horse was jogging along at a weary trot, beating the uneven, dusty road monotonously with its hoofs. The izvochik kept falling into a doze. Nekhludov sat without thinking of anything. At the bottom of a street, in front of a large house, a group of people had collected, and a convoy soldier stood by.
"What has happened?" Nekhludov asked of a porter. "Something the matter with a convict."
Nekhludov got down and came up to the group. On the rough stones, where the pavement slanted down to the gutter, lay a broadly built, red-bearded, elderly convict, with his head lower than his feet and very red in the face. He had a grey cloak and grey trousers on, and lay on his back, with the palms of his freckled hands downwards, and at long intervals his broad, high chest heaved, and he groaned while his bloodshot eyes were fixed on the sky. By him stood a cross-looking policeman, a peddler, a postman, a clerk, an old woman with a parasol, and a short-haired boy with an empty basket.
"They are weak. Having been locked up in prison, they've got weak, and then they lead them through the most broiling heat," said the clerk, addressing Nekhludov, who had just come up.
"He'll die, most likely," said the woman with a parasol, in a doleful tone.
"His shirt should be untied," said the postman.
The policeman began, with his thick, trembling fingers, clumsily to untie the tapes that fastened the shirt round the red, sinewy neck. He was evidently excited and confused, but still thought it necessary to address the crowd.
"What have you collected here for? It is hot enough without your keeping the wind off."
"They should have been examined by a doctor, and the weak ones left behind," said the clerk,
showing off his knowledge of the law. The policeman, having undone the tapes of the shirt, rose and looked round.
"Move on, I tell you. It is not your business, is it? What's there to stare at?" he said,
and turned to Nekhludov for sympathy, but not finding any in his face, he turned to the convoy soldier. But the soldier stood aside, examining the trodden-down heel of his boot, and was quite indifferent to the policeman's perplexity.
"Those whose business it is don't care.
Is it right to do men to death like this?
A convict is a convict, but still he is a man,"
different voices were heard saying in the crowd.
"Put his head up higher, and give him some water," said Nekhludov.
"Water has been sent for," said the policeman,
and taking the prisoner under the arms, he with difficulty pulled his body a little higher up.
"What's this gathering here?" said a decided, authoritative voice,
and a police officer with a wonderfully clean, shiny blouse and still more shiny top boots came up to the assembled crowd.
"Move on! No standing about here!" he shouted to the crowd before he knew what had attracted it.
When he came near and saw the dying convict, he made a sign of approval with his head, just as if he had quite expected it, and turning to the policeman said,
"How is this?"
The policeman said that, as a gang of prisoners was passing, one of the convicts had fallen down, and the convoy officer had ordered him to be left behind.
"Well, that's all right. He must be taken to the police station. Call an izvochik."
"A porter has gone for one," said the policeman,
with his fingers raised to his cap. The shopman began something about the heat.
"Is it your business, eh? Move on," said the police officer,
and looked so severely at him that the clerk was silenced. "He ought to have a little water," said Nekhludov. The police officer looked severely at Nekhludov also, but said nothing. When the porter brought a mug full of water, he told the policeman to offer some to the convict. The policeman raised the drooping head and tried to pour a little water down the mouth, but the prisoner could not swallow it, and it ran down his beard, wetting his jacket and his coarse, dirty linen shirt.
"Pour it on his head," ordered the officer,
and the policeman took off the pancake-shaped cap and poured the water over the red curls and bald part of the prisoner's head. His eyes opened wide, as if in fear, but his position remained unchanged. Streams of dirt trickled down his dusty face, but the mouth continued to gasp in the same regular way, and his whole body shook.
"And what's this?"
"Take this one,"
said the police officer, pointing to Nekludov's izvochik.
"You there, drive up."
"I am engaged," said the izvochik dismally, and without looking up. "It is my izvochik, but take him. I will pay you," said Nekludov, turning to the izvochik.
"Well, what are you waiting for?" shouted the officer. "Catch hold!"
The policeman, the porter, and the convoy soldier lifted the dying man and carried him to the trap, and put him on the seat. But he could not sit up. His head fell back, and the whole of his body glided off the seat.
"Make him lie down," ordered the officer.
"It's all right, Your Honour, I'll manage him like this," said the policeman, sitting down by the dying man and clasping his strong right arm round the body under the arms.
The convoy soldier lifted the stockingless feet in prison shoes and put them into the trap. The police officer looked round, and noticing the pancake-shaped hat of the convict, lifted it up and put it on the wet, drooping head.
"Go on,"
he ordered. The izvochik looked angrily round, shook his head, and accompanied by the convoy soldier, drove back to the police station. The policeman, sitting beside the convict, kept dragging up the body that was continually sliding down from the seat, while the head swung from side to side. The convoy soldier, who was walking by the side of the trap, kept putting the legs in their place. Nekludov followed the trap.
Chapter 37. Spilled like water on the ground.
The trap passed the fireman, who stood sentinel at the entrance. The headquarters of the fire brigade and the police stations are generally together in Moscow.
Drove into the yard of the police station and stopped at one of the doors. In the yard, several firemen with their sleeves tucked up were washing some kind of cart and talking loudly. When the trap stopped, several policemen surrounded it and, taking the lifeless body of the convict under the arms, took him out of the trap, which creaked under him. The policeman who had brought the body got down, shook his numbed arm, took off his cap and crossed himself. The body was carried through the door and up the stairs. Nekludov followed. In the small, dirty room where the body was taken, there stood four beds. On two of them sat a couple of sick men in dressing gowns, one with a crooked mouth whose neck was bandaged, the other one in consumption. Two of the beds were empty. The convict was laid on one of them. A little man with glistening eyes and continually moving brows, with only his underclothes and stockings on, came up with quick, soft steps, looked at the convict and then at Nekludov, and burst into loud laughter. This was a madman who was being kept in the police hospital.
"They wish to frighten me, but no, they won't succeed," he said.
The policemen who carried the corpse were followed by a police officer and a medical assistant. The medical assistant came up to the body and touched the freckled hand, already growing cold, which, though still soft, was deadly pale. He held it for a moment, and then let it go. It fell lifelessly on the stomach of the dead man.
"He's ready," said the medical assistant. But evidently, to be quite in order, he undid the wet brown shirt, and tossing back the curls from his ear, put it to the yellowish, broad, immovable chest of the convict. All was silent. The medical assistant raised himself again, shook his head, and touched with his fingers first one, and then the other lid over the open, fixed blue eyes.
"I'm not frightened! I'm not frightened!"
The madman kept repeating these words, and spitting in the direction of the medical assistant.
"Well?"
asked the police officer.
"Well, he must be put into the mortuary."
"Are you sure, mind?"
said the police officer.
"It's time I should know," said the medical assistant, drawing the shirt over the body's chest. "However, I will send for Matthew Ivanovich. Let him have a look. Petrov, call him."
And the medical assistant stepped away from the body.
"Take him to the mortuary," said the police officer, "and then you must come into the office and sign. he added to the convoy soldier, who had not left the convict for a moment.
"Yes, sir," said the soldier.
The policemen lifted the body and carried it down again. Nekhludov wished to follow, but the madman kept him back.
"You are not in the plot. Well then, give me a cigarette," he said.
Nekhludov got out his cigarette case and gave him one. The madman, quickly moving his brows all the time, began relating how they tormented him by thought suggestion.
"Why, they are all against me, and torment and torture me through their mediums."
"I beg your pardon," said Nekhludov, and without listening any further he left the room and went out into the yard, wishing to know where the body would be put. The policemen, with their burden, had already crossed the yard and were coming to the door of a cellar. Nekhludov wished to go up to them, but the police officer stopped him.
"What do you want?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing? Then go away."
Nekhludov obeyed and went back to his izvochik, who was dozing. He awoke him, and they drove back towards the railway station. They had not made 100 steps when they met a cart accompanied by a convoy soldier with a gun. On the cart lay another convict, who was already dead. The convict lay on his back in the cart, his shaved head, from which the pancake-shaped cap had slid over the black bearded face down to the nose, shaking and thumping at every jolt. The driver, in his heavy boots, walked by the side of the cart holding the reins. A policeman followed on foot. Nekhludov touched his izvochik's shoulder.
"Just look what they're doing,"
said the izvochik, stopping his horse. Nekhludov got down and, following the cart, again passed the sentinel and entered the gate of the police station. By this time the firemen had finished washing the cart, and a tall, bony man, the chief of the fire brigade, with a coloured band round his cap, stood in their place, and, with his hands in his pockets, was severely looking at a fat-necked, well-fed bay stallion that was being led up and down before him by a fireman. The stallion was lame on one of his forefeet, and the chief of the firemen was angrily saying something to a veterinary who stood by. The police officer was also present. When he saw the cart, he went up to the convoy soldier.
"Where did you bring him from?"
he asked, shaking his head disapprovingly.
"From the Gorbatovskaya," answered the policeman.
"A prisoner?"
asked the chief of the fire brigade.
"Yes, it's the second today." "Well, I must say they've got some queer arrangements. Though, of course, it's a broiling day," said the chief of the fire brigade.
Then, turning to the fireman who was leading the lame stallion, he shouted,
"Put him into the corner stall! And as to you, you hound, I'll teach you how to cripple horses which are worth more than you are, you scoundrel!"
The dead man was taken from the cart by the policemen just in the same way as the first had been, and carried upstairs into the hospital. Nekhludov followed them as if he were hypnotized.
"What do you want?"
asked one of the policemen. But Nekhludov did not answer, and followed where the body was being carried. The madman, sitting on a bed, was smoking greedily the cigarette Nekhludov had given him.
"Ah, you've come back!" he said and laughed.
When he saw the body he made a face and said,
"Again! I'm sick of it! I'm not a boy, am I, hey?"
And he turned to Nekhludov with a questioning smile. Nekhludov was looking at the dead man, whose face, which had been hidden by his cap, was now visible. This convict was as handsome in face and body as the other was hideous. He was a man in the full bloom of life. Notwithstanding that he was disfigured by the half of his head being shaved, the straight, rather low forehead, raised a bit over the black, lifeless eyes, was very fine, and so was the nose above the thin black moustaches. There was a smile on the lips that were already growing blue. A small beard outlined the lower part of the face, and on the shaved side of the head a firm, well-shaped ear was visible. One could see what possibilities of a higher life had been destroyed in this man. The fine bones of his hands and shackled feet, the strong muscles of all his well-proportioned limbs, showed what a beautiful, strong, agile human animal this had been. As an animal merely he had been a far more perfect one of his kind than the bay stallion, about the laming of which the fireman was so angry. Yet he had been done to death, and no one was sorry for him as a man, nor was any one sorry that so fine a working animal had perished. The only feeling evinced was that of annoyance because of the bother caused by the necessity of getting this body, threatening putrefaction, out of the way. The doctor and his assistant entered the hospital, accompanied by the inspector of the police station.
The doctor was a thick-set man, dressed in pongee silk coat and trousers of the same material, closely fitting his muscular thighs. The inspector was a little fat fellow with a red face, round as a ball, which he made still broader by a habit he had of filling his cheeks with air and slowly letting it out again. The doctor sat down on the bed by the side of the dead man and touched the hands in the same way as his assistant had done, put his ear to the heart, rose, and pulled his trousers straight.
"Could not be more dead," he said.
The inspector filled his mouth with air and slowly blew it out again.
"Which prison is he from?"
he asked the convoy soldier. The soldier told him and reminded him of the chains on the dead man's feet.
"I'll have them taken off. We have got a smith about, the Lord be thanked," said the inspector, and blew up his cheeks again.
He went towards the door, slowly letting out the air. "Why has this happened?" Nekhludov asked the doctor. The doctor looked at him through his spectacles.
"Why has what happened? Why, they die of sunstroke, you mean? This is why. They sit all through the winter without exercise and without light, and suddenly they are taken out into the sunshine. And on a day like this, and they march in a crowd so that they get no air, and sunstroke is the result."
"Then why are they sent out?"
"Oh, as to that, go and ask those who send them. But may I ask who you are?"
"I am a stranger."
"Ah, well, good afternoon. I have no time."
The doctor was vexed. He gave his trousers a downward pull and went towards the beds of the sick.
"Well, how are you getting on?"
he asked the pale man with the crooked mouth and bandaged neck. Meanwhile, the madman sat on a bed, and having finished his cigarette, kept spitting in the direction of the doctor. Nekhludov went down into the yard and out of the gate, past the fireman's horses and the hens and the sentinel in his brass helmet, and got into the trap, the driver of which had again fallen asleep. Chapter 38. The Convict Train. When Nekhludov came to the station, the prisoners were all seated in railway carriages with grated windows. Several persons, come to see them off, stood on the platform, but were not allowed to come up to the carriages. The convoy was much troubled that day. On the way from the prison to the station, besides the two Nekhludov had seen, three other prisoners had fallen and died of sunstroke. One was taken to the nearest police station, like the first two, and the other two died at the railway station. The convoy men were not troubled because five men who might have been alive died while in their charge. This did not trouble them, but they were concerned lest anything that the law required in such cases should be omitted. To convey the bodies to the places appointed, to deliver up their papers, to take them off the lists of those to be conveyed to Nizhny, all this was very troublesome, especially on so hot a day. It was this that occupied the convoy men, and before it could all be accomplished, Nekhludov and the others who asked for leave to go up to the carriages were not allowed to do so. Nekhludov, however, was soon allowed to go up, because he tipped the convoy sergeant. The sergeant let Nekhludov pass, but asked him to be quick and get his talk over before any of the authorities noticed. There were 15 carriages in all, and except one carriage for the officials, they were full of prisoners. As Nekhludov passed the carriages, he listened to what was going on in them. In all the carriages was heard the clanging of chains, the sound of bustle mixed with loud and senseless language. But not a word was being said about their dead fellow prisoners. The talk was all about sacks, drinking water, and the choice of seats. Looking into one of the carriages, Nekhludov saw convoy soldiers taking the manacles off the hands of the prisoners. The prisoners held out their arms, and one of the soldiers unlocked the manacles with a key and took them off. The other collected them. After he had passed all the other carriages, Nekhludov came up to the women's carriages. From the second of these he heard a woman's groans.
"Oh, oh, oh, oh God! Oh, oh, oh God!"
Nekhludov passed this carriage and went up to a window of the third carriage, which a soldier pointed out to him. When he approached his face to the window, he felt the hot air filled with the smell of perspiration coming out of it, and heard distinctly the shrill sound of women's voices. All the seats were filled with red, perspiring, loudly talking women dressed in prison cloaks and white jackets. Nekhludov's face at the window attracted their attention. Those nearest ceased talking and drew closer. Maslova, in her white jacket and her head uncovered, sat by the opposite window. The white-skinned, smiling Theodosia sat a little nearer.
When she recognized Nekhludov, she nudged Maslova and pointed to the window. Maslova rose hurriedly, threw her kerchief over her black hair, and with a smile on her hot, red face, came up to the window and took hold of one of the bars.
"Well, it is hot," she said with a glad smile.
"Did you get the things?"
"Yes, thank you."
"Is there anything more you want?" asked Nekhludov, while the air came out of the hot carriage as out of an oven.
"I want nothing, thank you."
"If we could get a drink," said Theodosia.
"Yes, if we could get a drink," repeated Maslova.
"Why, have you not got any water?"
"They put some in, but it is all gone."
"Directly. I will ask one of the convoy men. Now we shall not see each other till we get to Nizhny."
"Why, are you going?"
said Maslova, as if she did not know it, and looked joyfully at Nekhludov. "I'm going by the next train." Maslova said nothing, but only sighed deeply.
"Is it true, sir, that 12 convicts have been done to death?" said a severe-looking old prisoner, with a deep voice like a man's.
It was Karablyova. "I did not hear of 12. I have seen 2, said Nekhludov.
"They say there were 12 they killed, and will nothing be done to them? Only think, the fiends!"
"And have none of the women fallen ill?" Nekhludov asked.
"Women are stronger,"
said another of the prisoners, a short little woman, and laughed.
"Only there's one that has taken it into her head to be delivered. There she goes,"
she said, pointing to the next carriage, whence proceeded the groans.
"You ask if we want anything,"
said Maslova, trying to keep the smile of joy from her lips.
"Could not this woman be left behind, suffering as she is? There, now, if you would tell the authorities."
"Yes, I will."
"And one thing more. Could she not see her husband, Taras?"
she added, pointing with her eyes to the smiling Theodosia. "He is going with you, is he not?"
"Sir, you must not talk,"
said a convoy sergeant, not the one who had let Nekhludov come up. Nekhludov left the carriage and went in search of an official to whom he might speak for the woman in travail and about Taras, but could not find him, nor get an answer from any of the convoy for a long time. They were all in a bustle. Some were leading a prisoner somewhere or other, others running to get themselves provisions. Some were placing their things in the carriages, or attending on a lady who was going to accompany the convoy officer, and they answered Nekhludov's questions unwillingly. Nekhludov found the convoy officer only after the second bell had been rung. The officer, with his short arm, was wiping the moustaches that covered his mouth and shrugging his shoulders, reproving the corporal for something or other.
"What is it you want?"
he asked Nekhludov. "You've got a woman there who has been confined, so I thought best—"
"Well, let her be confined. We shall see later on."
And briskly swinging his short arms, he ran up to his carriage. At the moment the guard passed with a whistle in his hand, and from the people on the platform and from the women's carriages there arose a sound of weeping and words of prayer. Nekhludov stood on the platform by the side of Taras, and looked how, one after the other, the carriages glided past him with the shaved heads of the men at the grated windows. Then the first of the women's carriages came up, with women's heads at the windows, some covered with kerchiefs and some uncovered, then the second, whence proceeded the same groans, then the carriage where Maslova was. She stood with the others at the window, and looked at Nekhludov with a pathetic smile. Chapter 39 Brother and Sister. There were still 2 hours before the passenger train by which Nekhludov was going would start. He had thought of using this interval to see his sister again, but after the impressions of the morning he felt much excited and so done up that, sitting down on a sofa in the first-class refreshment room, he suddenly grew so drowsy that he turned over onto his side and, laying his face on his hand, fell asleep at once. A waiter in a dress coat with a napkin in his hand woke him.
"Sir, sir, are you not Prince Nekhludov? There's a lady looking for you."
Nekhludov started up and recollected where he was, and all that had happened in the morning. He saw in his imagination the procession of prisoners, the dead bodies, the railway carriages with barred windows, and the women locked up in them, one of whom was groaning in travail with no one to help her, and another who was pathetically smiling at him through the bars. The reality before his eyes was very different, i.e., a table with vases, candlesticks and crockery, and agile waiters moving round the table, and in the background a cupboard and a counter laden with fruit and bottles, behind it a barman,
and in front the backs of passengers who had come up for refreshments. When Nekhludov had risen and sat gradually collecting his thoughts, he noticed that everybody in the room was inquisitively looking at something that was passing by the open doors. He also looked, and saw a group of people carrying a chair on which sat a lady, whose head was wrapped in a kind of airy fabric. Nekhludov thought he knew the footman who was supporting the chair in front, and also the man behind, and a doorkeeper with gold cord on his cap seemed familiar. A lady's maid with a fringe and an apron, who was carrying a parcel, a parasol, and something round in a leather case, was walking behind the chair. Then came Prince Korchagin, with his thick lips, apoplectic neck, and a travelling cap on his head. Behind him, Missy, her cousin Misha, and an acquaintance of Nekhludov's, the long-necked diplomat Austin, with his protruding Adam's apple and his unvarying merry mood and expression. He was saying something very emphatically, though jokingly, to the smiling Missy. The Korchagins were moving from their estate near the city to the estate of the princess's sister on the Nizhny Railway. The procession, the men carrying the chair, the maid, and the doctor, vanished into the ladies' waiting-room, evoking a feeling of curiosity and respect in the onlookers. But the old prince remained and sat down at the table, called a waiter, and ordered food and drink. Missy and Austin also remained in the refreshment room and were about to sit down when they saw an acquaintance in the doorway and went up to her. It was Natalie Rogozhinsky. Natalie came into the refreshment room accompanied by Agrafena Petrovna, and both looked round the room. Natalie noticed at one and the same moment both her brother and Missy. She first went up to Missy, only nodding to her brother, but having kissed her at once turned to him.
"At last I have found you," she said.
Nekhludov rose to greet Missy, Misha, and Austin, and to say a few words to them. Missy told him about their house in the country having been burnt down, which necessitated their moving to her aunt's. Austin began relating a funny story about a fire. Nekhludov paid no attention and turned to his sister. "How glad I am that you have come."
"I have been here a long time," she said. "Agrafena Petrovna is with me."
And she pointed to Agrafena Petrovna, who, in a waterproof and with a bonnet on her head, stood some way off, and bowed to him with kindly dignity and some confusion, not wishing to intrude.
"We looked for you everywhere."
"And I had fallen asleep here. How glad I am that you have come," repeated Nekhludov. "I had begun to write to you."
"Really?"
she said, looking frightened.
"What about?"
Missy and the gentleman, noticing that an intimate conversation was about to commence between the brother and sister, went away. Nekhludov and his sister sat down by the window on a velvet-covered sofa, on which lay a plaid, a box, and a few other things. "Yesterday, after I left you, I felt inclined to return and express my regret, but I did not know how he would take it," said Nekhludov. "I spoke hastily to your husband, and this tormented me."
"I knew," said his sister, "that you did not mean to. Oh, you know!"
And the tears came to her eyes, and she touched his hand. The sentence was not clear, but he understood it perfectly, and was touched by what it expressed. Her words meant that, besides the love for her husband which held her in its sway, she prized and considered important the love she had for him, her brother, and that every misunderstanding between them caused her deep suffering.
"Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, what I have seen today," he said, suddenly recalling the second of the dead convicts. 2 prisoners have been done to death."
"Done to death? How?"
"Yes, done to death. They led them in this heat, and 2 died of sunstroke."
"Impossible! What, today? Just now?"
"Yes, just now. I have seen their bodies."
"But why done to death? Who killed them?" asked Natalie.
"They who forced them to go killed them," said Nekhludov, with irritation, feeling that she looked at this, too, with her husband's eyes.
"Oh, Lord!"
said Agrafena Petrovna, who had come up to them. "Yes, we have not the slightest idea of what is being done to these unfortunate beings, but it ought to be known," added Nekhludov, and looked at old Korchagin, who sat with a napkin tied round him and a bottle before him, and who looked round at Nekhludov.
"Nekhludov!" he called out. "Won't you join me and take some refreshment? It is excellent before a journey."
Nekhludov refused and turned away.
"But what are you going to do?"
Natalie continued. "What I can. I don't know, but I feel I must do something, and I shall do what I am able to."
"Yes, I understand. And how about them?"
she continued with a smile and a look towards Korchagin.
"Is it possible that it is all over?"
"Completely. And I think, without any regret on either side."
"It is a pity. I am sorry. I am fond of her. However, it's all right. But why do you wish to bind yourself?"
she added shyly.
"Why are you going?"
"I go because I must," answered Nekhludov, seriously and dryly, as if wishing to stop this conversation. But he felt ashamed of his coldness towards his sister at once. "Why not tell her all I am thinking," he thought, "and let Agrafena Petrovna also hear it," he thought, with a look at the old servant whose presence made the wish to repeat his decision to his sister even stronger. "You mean my intention to marry Katyusha? Well, you see, I made up my mind to do it, but she refuses, definitely and firmly," he said, and his voice shook, as it always did when he spoke of it. "She does not wish to accept my sacrifice, but is herself sacrificing what in her position means much, and I cannot accept this sacrifice if it is only a momentary impulse. And so I am going with her, and shall be where she is, and shall try to lighten her fate as much as I can." Natalie said nothing. Agrafena Petrovna looked at her with a questioning look and shook her head. At this moment the former procession issued from the ladies' room. The same handsome footman, Philip, and the doorkeeper were carrying the Princess Korchagin. She stopped the men who were carrying her and motioned Nekhludov to approach, and with a pitiful, languishing air she extended her white, ringed hand, expecting the firm pressure of his hand with a sense of horror.
"Épouvantable," she said, meaning the heat. "I cannot stand it. Ce climat m'étouffe."
And after a short talk about the horrors of the Russian climate, she gave the men a sign to go on.
"Be sure and come," she added, turning her long face towards Nekhludov as she was borne away.
The procession with the princess turned to the right towards the first-class carriages. Nekhludov, with the porter who was carrying his things, and Taras, with his bag, turned to the left. "This is my companion," said Nekhludov to his sister, pointing to Taras, whose story he had told her before.
"Surely not third class," said Natalie,
when Nekhludov stopped in front of a third-class carriage, and Taras and the porter with the things went in. "Yes, it is more convenient for me to be with Taras," he said.
"One thing more," he added.
"Up to now I have not given the Kuzminsky land to the peasants, so that, in case of my death, your children will inherit it."
"Dmitri, don't," said Natalie.
"If I do give it away, all I can say is that the rest will be theirs, as it is not likely I shall marry. And if I do marry, I shall have no children, so that—"
"Dmitri, don't talk like that," said Natalie.
And yet Nekhludov noticed that she was glad to hear him say it. Higher up, by the side of a first-class carriage, there stood a group of people still looking at the carriage into which the Princess Korchagin had been carried. Most of the passengers were already seated. Some of the late-comers hurriedly clattered along the boards of the platform. The guard was closing the doors and asking the passengers to get in, and those who were seeing them off to come out. Nekhludov entered the hot-smelling carriage, but at once stepped out again onto the small platform at the back of the carriage. Natalie stood opposite the carriage with her fashionable bonnet and cape by the side of Agrafena Petrovna, and was evidently trying to find something to say. She could not even say écrivez, because they had long ago laughed at this word, habitually spoken by those about to part. The short conversation about money matters had in a moment destroyed the tender, brotherly and sisterly feelings that had taken hold of them. They felt estranged, so that Natalie was glad when the train moved, and she could only say, nodding her head with a sad and tender look,
"Goodbye. Goodbye, Dmitri."
But as soon as the carriage had passed her, she thought of how she should repeat her conversation with her brother to her husband, and her face became serious and troubled. Nekhludov, too, though he had nothing but the kindest feelings for his sister, and had hidden nothing from her, now felt depressed and uncomfortable with her, and was glad to part. He felt that the Natalie who was once so near to him no longer existed, and her place was only a slave of that hairy, unpleasant husband who was so foreign to him. He saw it clearly when her face lit up with peculiar animation as he spoke of what would peculiarly interest her husband, i.e., the giving up of the land to the peasants and the inheritance. And this made him sad. Chapter 40. The Fundamental Law of Human Life. The heat in the large third-class carriage, which had been standing in the burning sun all day, was so great that Nekhludov did not go in, but stopped on the little platform behind the carriage, which formed a passage to the next one. But there was not a breath of fresh air here either, and Nekhludov breathed freely only when the train had passed the buildings and the draught blew across the platform. "Yes, killed," he repeated to himself, the words he had used to his sister. And in his imagination, in the midst of all other impressions, there arose with wonderful clearness the beautiful face of the second dead convict, with the smile of the lips, the severe expression of the brows, and the small, firm ear below the shaved, bluish skull. And what seemed terrible was that he had been murdered, and no one knew who had murdered him, yet he had been murdered. He was led out, like all the rest of the prisoners, by Maslennikov's orders. Maslennikov had probably given the order in the usual manner, had signed with his stupid flourish the paper with a printed heading, and most certainly would not consider himself guilty. Still less would the careful doctor who examined the convicts consider himself guilty. He had performed his duty accurately and had separated the weak. How could he have foreseen this terrible heat, or the fact that they would start so late in the day and in such crowds? The prison inspector? But the inspector had only carried into execution the order that on a given day a certain number of exiles and convicts, men and women, had to be sent off. The convoy officer could not be guilty either, for his business was to receive a certain number of persons in a certain place, and to deliver up the same number. He conducted them in the usual manner, and could not foresee that two such strong men as those Nekhludov saw would not be able to stand it and would die. No one is guilty, and yet the men have been murdered by these people who are not guilty of their murder. All this comes, Nekhludov thought, from the fact that all these people, governors, inspectors, police officers, and men, consider that there are circumstances in which human relations are not necessary between human beings. All these men, Maslennikov and the inspector and the convoy officer, if they were not governor-inspector-officer, would have considered 20 times before sending people in such heat, in such a mass, would have stopped 20 times on the way, and, seeing that a man was growing weak, gasping for breath, would have led him into the shade, would have given him water and let him rest, and if an accident had still occurred, they would have expressed pity. But they not only did not do it, but hindered others from doing it, because they considered not men and their duty towards them, but only the office they themselves filled, and held what that office demanded of them to be above human relations. That's what it is. Nekhludov went on in his thoughts. If one acknowledges but for a single hour that anything can be more important than love for one's fellow men, even in some one exceptional case, any crime can be committed without a feeling of guilt. Nekhludov was so engrossed by his thoughts that he did not notice how the weather changed. The sun was covered over by a low-hanging, ragged cloud. A compact, light-grey cloud was rapidly coming from the west, and was already falling in heavy, driving rain on the fields and woods far in the distance. Moisture coming from the cloud mixed with the air. Now and then the cloud was rent by flashes of lightning, and peals of thunder mingled more and more often with the rattling of the train. The cloud came nearer and nearer. The raindrops, driven by the wind, began to spot the platform and Nekhludov's coat, and he stepped to the other side of the little platform and, inhaling the fresh, moist air, filled with the smell of corn and wet earth that had long been waiting for rain, he stood looking at the gardens, the woods, the yellow rye fields, the green oat fields, the dark green strips of potatoes in bloom that glided past. Everything looked as if covered over with varnish. The green turned greener, the yellow yellower, the black blacker. "More! More!"
said Nekhludov, gladdened by the sight of gardens and fields revived by the beneficent shower. The shower did not last long. Part of the cloud had come down in rain, part passed over, and the last fine drops fell straight onto the earth. The sun reappeared. Everything began to glisten, and in the east, not very high above the horizon, appeared a bright rainbow with a violet tint very distinct, and broken only at one end. "Why, what was I thinking about?" Nekhludov asked himself, when all these changes in nature were over, and the train ran into a cutting between two high banks. "Oh, I was thinking that all those people—inspector, convoy men, all those in the service—are for the greater part kind people. Cruel only because they are serving." He recalled Maslennikov's indifference when he told him about what was being done in the prison, the inspector's severity, the cruelty of the convoy officer when he refused places on the carts to those who asked for them, and paid no attention to the fact that there was a woman in travail in the train. All these people were evidently invulnerable and impregnable to the simplest feelings of compassion only because they held offices. As officials, they were impermeable to the feelings of humanity, as this paved ground is impermeable to the rain. Thus thought Nekhludov, as he looked at the railway embankment, paved with stones of different colours, down which the water was running in streams instead of soaking into the earth. Perhaps it is necessary to pave the banks with stones, but it is sad to look at the ground, which might be yielding corn, grass, bushes, or trees, in the same way as the ground visible up there is doing, deprived of vegetation. And so it is with men, thought Nekhludov. Perhaps these governors, inspectors, policemen are needed, but it is terrible to see men deprived of the chief human attribute, that of love and sympathy for one another. The thing is, he continued, that these people consider lawful what is not lawful, and do not consider the eternal, immutable law written in the hearts of men by God as law. That is why I feel so depressed when I am with these people. I am simply afraid of them, and really they are terrible, more terrible than robbers. A robber might, after all, feel pity, but they can feel no pity. They are inured against pity, as these stones are against vegetation. That is what makes them terrible. It is said that the Pugachevs, the Razins, leaders of rebellions in Russia, Stonka Razin in the 17th and Pugachev in the 18th century, are terrible. These are 1,000 times more terrible, he continued, in his thoughts. If a psychological problem was set to find means of making men of our time, Christian, humane, simple, kind people, perform the most horrible crimes without feeling guilty, only one solution could be devised: to go on doing what is being done. It is only necessary that these people should be governors, inspectors, policemen, that they should be fully convinced that there is a kind of business called government service which allows men to treat other men as things, without human brotherly relations with them, and also that these people should be so linked together by this government service that the responsibility for the results of their actions should not fall on any one of them separately. Without these conditions, the terrible acts I witnessed today would be impossible in our times. It all lies in the fact that men think there are circumstances in which one may deal with human beings without love. And there are no such circumstances. One may deal with things without love. One may cut down trees, make bricks, hammer iron without love, but you cannot deal with men without it, just as one cannot deal with bees without being careful. If you deal carelessly with bees, you will injure them, and will yourself be injured. And so with men. It cannot be otherwise, because natural love is the fundamental law of human life. It is true that a man cannot force another to love him, as he can force him to work for him, but it does not follow that a man may deal with men without love, especially to demand anything from them. If you feel no love, sit still, Nekhludov thought. Occupy yourself with things, with yourself, with anything you like, only not with men. You can only eat without injuring yourself when you feel inclined to eat, so you can only deal with men usefully when you love. Only let yourself deal with a man without love, as I did yesterday with my brother-in-law, and there are no limits to the suffering you will bring on yourself, as all my life proves. Yes, yes, it is so, thought Nekhludov. It is good. Yes, it is good, he repeated. enjoying the freshness after the torturing heat, and conscious of having attained to the fullest clearness on a question that had long occupied him. Chapter 41. Taras's Story. The carriage in which Nekhludov had taken his place was half filled with people. There were in it servants, working men, factory hands, butchers, Jews, shopmen, workmen's wives, a soldier, two ladies, a young one, and an old one with bracelets on her arm, and a severe-looking gentleman with a cockade on his black cap. All these people were sitting quietly. The bustle of taking their places was long over. Some sat cracking and eating sunflower seeds, some smoking, some talking. Taras sat, looking very happy, opposite the door, keeping a place for Nekhludov, and carrying on an animated conversation with a man in a cloth coat who sat opposite to him, and who was, as Nekhludov afterwards found out, a gardener going to a new situation. Before reaching the place where Taras sat, Nekhludov stopped between the seats near a reverend-looking old man with a white beard and nankeen coat, who was talking with a young woman in peasant dress. A little girl of about 7, dressed in a new peasant costume, sat, her little legs dangling above the floor by the side of the woman, and kept cracking seeds. The old man turned round, and, seeing Nekhludov, he moved the lappets of his coat off the varnished seat next to him, and said in a friendly manner,
"Please, here's a seat."
Nekhludov thanked him and took the seat. As soon as he was seated, the woman continued the interrupted conversation. She was returning to her village, and related how her husband, whom she had been visiting, had received her in town.
"I was there during the carnival, and now, by the Lord's help, I've been again," she said. "Then, God willing, at Christmas I'll go again."
"That's right," said the old man, with a look at Nekhludov. "It's the best way to go and see him. Else a young man can easily go to the bad, living in a town."
"Oh, no, sir, mine is not such a man. No nonsense of any kind about him. His life is as good as a young maiden's. The money he earns, he sends home all to a kopeck. And as to our girl here, he was so glad to see her, there are no words for it," said the woman, and smiled.
The little girl, who sat cracking her seeds and spitting out the shells, listened to her mother's words, and, as if to confirm them, looked up with calm, intelligent eyes into Nekhludov's and the old man's faces.
"Well, if he's good, that's better still," said the old man. "And none of that sort of thing?" he added, with a look at a couple, evidently factory hands, who sat at the other side of the carriage.
The husband, with his head thrown back, was pouring vodka down his throat out of a bottle, and the wife sat holding a bag out of which they had taken the bottle, and watched him intently.
"No, mine neither drinks nor smokes," said the woman, who was conversing with the old man, glad of the opportunity of praising her husband once more. "No, sir, the earth does not hold many such." And turning to Nekhludov, she added, "That's the sort of man he is."
"What could be better?" said the old man,
looking at the factory worker who had had his drink and had passed the bottle to his wife. The wife laughed, shook her head, and also raised the bottle to her lips. Noticing Nekhludov's and the old man's look directed towards them, the factory worker addressed the former.
"What is it, sir, that we are drinking? Ah, no one sees how we work, but everyone sees how we drink. I've earned it, and I'm drinking and treating my wife and no one else."
"Yes, yes," said Nekhludov, not knowing what to say.
"True, sir. My wife is a steady woman. I am satisfied with my wife because she can feel for me. Is it right what I'm saying, Mavra?"
"There you are. Take it. I don't want any more,"
said the wife, returning the bottle to him.
"And what are you jawing for like that?" she added.
"There now. She's good. That good. And suddenly she'll begin squeaking like a wheel that's not greased. Mavra, is it right what I'm saying?"
Mavra laughed and moved her hand with a tipsy gesture.
"Oh, my, he's at it again."
"There now, she's that good, that good. But let her get her tail over the reins, and you can't think what she'll be up to. Is it right what I'm saying? You must excuse me, sir, I've had a drop." "What's to be done?" said the factory worker,
and, preparing to go to sleep, put his head in his wife's lap. Nekhludov sat a while with the old man, who told him all about himself. The old man was a stove-builder who had been working for 53 years, and had built so many stoves that he had lost count, and now he wanted to rest, but had no time. He had been to town and found employment for the young ones, and was now going to the country to see the people at home. After hearing the old man's story, Nekhludov went to the place that Taras was keeping for him.
"That's all right, sir. Sit down. We'll put the bag here," said the gardener, who sat opposite Taras, in a friendly tone, looking up into Nekhludov's face.
"Rather a tight fit, but no matter, since we're friends," said Taras, smiling and lifting the bag, which weighed more than 5 stone, as if it were a feather. He carried it across to the window.
"Plenty of room. Besides, we might stand up a bit, and even under the seat it's as comfortable as you could wish. What's the good of humbugging?"
he said, beaming with friendliness and kindness. Taras spoke of himself as being unable to utter a word when quite sober, but drink, he said, helped him to find the right words, and then he could express everything. And in reality, when he was sober, Taras kept silent. But when he had been drinking, which happened rarely and only on special occasions, he became very pleasantly talkative. Then he spoke a great deal, spoke well, and very simply and truthfully, and especially with great kindliness, which shone in his gentle blue eyes, and in the friendly smile that never left his lips. He was in such a state today. Nekhludov's approach interrupted the conversation, but when he had put the bag in its place, Taras sat down again, and with his strong hands folded in his lap, and looking straight into the gardener's face, continued his story. He was telling his new acquaintance about his wife, and giving every detail, what she was being sent to Siberia for, and why he was now following her. Nekhludov had never heard a detailed account of this affair, and so he listened with interest. When he came up, the story had reached the point when the attempt to poison was already an accomplished fact, and the family had discovered that it was Theodosia's doing.
"It's about my troubles that I'm talking," said Taras,
addressing Nekhludov with cordial friendliness.
"I have chanced to come across such a hearty man, and we've got into conversation, and I'm telling him all."
"I see," said Nekhludov.
"Well, then in this way, my friend, the business became known. Mother, she takes that cake. 'I'm going,' says she, 'to the police officer. My father is just an old man.' 'Wait, wife,' says he, 'the little woman is a mere child and did not herself know what she was doing. We must have pity. She may come to her senses, but dear me, mother would not hear of it. While we keep her here,' she says, 'she may destroy us all like cockroaches.' Well, friend, so she goes off for the police officer. He bounces in upon us at once, calls for witnesses."
"Well, and you?" asked the gardener.
"Well, I, you see, friend, roll about with a pain in my stomach and vomit. All my inside is turned inside out. I can't even speak. Well, so father, he goes and harnesses the mare and puts Theodosia into the cart, and is off to the police station and then to the magistrates. And she, you know, just as she had done from the first, so also there, confesses all to the magistrate, where she got the arsenic and how she kneaded the cake. 'Why did you do it?' says he. 'Why?' says she. 'Because he's hateful to me. I prefer Siberia to a life with him. That's me.'"
And Taras smiled.
"Well, so she confessed all. Then, naturally, the prison and father returns alone. And harvest time just coming, and mother the only woman at home, and she no longer strong. So we think what we are to do. Could we not bail her out? So father went to see an official. No go. Then another. I think he went to 5 of them, and we thought of giving it up. Then we happened to come across a clerk, such an artful one as you don't often find. 'You give me 5 roubles and I'll get her out,' says he. He agreed to do it for 3. Well, and what do you think, friend? I went and pawned the linen she herself had woven and gave him the money.